This, too, might have marked the completion of the revolution. But once again, as the massacre had spelt out in blood, a gap had opened up between the people and their representatives. And this time, in Paris at least, the voice of the people was increasingly the voice of republicanism. The successor to the Constituent Assembly, the Legislative Assembly, met on the 1st of October 1791. It promised a fresh start. No one who had served in the Constituent Assembly had been allowed to stand for election to it. As a result, its membership was dominated by younger people, for whom the last couple of years had been a steep learning curve in how to make a revolution work at local level. It also included the radical Brissot, who made the leap from journalist to deputy without breaking his stride. Within days, Brissot was making all the running, electrifying debate with his demand that France threaten neighbouring states with war if they sheltered or supported the émigrés camped on her borders. By the beginning of 1792, the war question dominated all others. There were hidden agenda on every side. Brissot and his supporters, soon to be known as Girondins, after the area of France from which several of them came, hoped that war would unite the country against a common enemy, or at least flush out counter-revolutionaries at home. For Louis XVI, convinced that France's depleted army could never win, war offered the possibility of reversing the revolution with foreign help. In March, under pressure from Brissot, the king appointed a new hawkish ministry, which included Charles-François Dumouriez, a patriot general and veteran of the Seven Years' War. On the 20th of April, Louis attended the assembly to read a formal declaration of war against his own nephew, Leopold's Austrian successor, Francis II. It would be 23 years before Europe saw peace again. The start of the French Revolutionary War was a milestone in the geopolitics of the continent. But it also transformed the political landscape of France. The fortunes of the revolution were now indissolubly bound to the fortunes of war. So, too, was the fate of Louis XVI. Things started badly for France. The army was chronically weakened by the emigration of so many of its officers, and mutinies had damaged morale and discipline. Tens of thousands of national volunteers joined up on a wave of patriotic fervour, but they were poorly trained and equipped. The first engagements, incursions across the northeast frontier into the Austrian Netherlands, saw the French forces easily routed. One French general was even murdered by his own men, who suspected him of treason. Such suspicions soon extended to the top of the ladder of state. There had long been talk of a so-called Austrian committee at court. As the military setbacks mounted, the king and queen were now widely accused of betraying France to the enemy. Against this background, the assembly took steps to neutralize untrustworthy elements at home. Foreigners were to be kept under surveillance, non-jura priests deported if denounced by 20 citizens. The royal bodyguard was disbanded. But when the assembly proposed creating a camp of 20,000 provincial volunteers, or fédérés, near Paris, Louis used his constitutional veto. For good measure, he also vetoed the decree on non-jurors. Then, when his own interior minister publicly criticized the vetoes, Louis summarily dismissed him and his fellow ministers and replaced them with a more conservative administration. There was an upsurge of popular anger. In recent weeks, a new political label had been heard on the streets of the capital, sans culottes. Literally, without knee breeches, these being seen as the dress of the wealthy, sans culottes was the self-description adopted by radical activists in the Paris sections, many of whom were far from being horny-handed sons of toil. Now, on the 20th of June, thousands of armed sans culottes stormed the Tuileries. Breaking into the palace, they lugged a cannon up the main staircase, smashing down doors until they found the king. They pinned him into a corner and harangued him for 2 hours with their demands, which included reinstatement of the sacked ministers and the lifting of his vetoes. At this moment of high personal crisis, Louis showed astonishing self-possession. he stood his ground, insisting that he was a friend to the nation and its constitution. He even put on the red liberty cap he was offered, the latest revolutionary fashion statement, and drank a toast to the people of France. When Bailly's radical successor as mayor of Paris, Jérôme Pétion, belatedly arrived on the scene, the crowd dispersed without further affray. But everyone knew this was only a respite, a tactical retreat. Events continued to unfold at a dizzying pace. Ignoring Louis's veto, the Assembly pressed ahead with its decrees. With Prussia now entering the war in earnest, on the 11th of July, the deputies declared a state of national emergency, the so-called Patrie en danger, or Fatherland in danger. Government bodies remained in permanent session, and thousands of new volunteers were recruited in the provinces. Throughout July, as Paris prepared to celebrate the third anniversary of the fall of the Bastille, these fédérés converged on the capital en route to the front, adding another volatile element to the city's radical mix. The contingent from Marseille arrived singing a newly composed battle song of the Rhine army, a rousing call to arms which immediately caught on. Known ever since as the Marseillaise, it is now the French national anthem. Meanwhile, the distinction between active and non-active citizens collapsed, opening the National Guard and the section assemblies to the insurgent radicalism of the sans-culottes. "When you undertake to run a revolution," Mirabeau had warned before his death the previous year, "the difficulty is not to make it go, it is to hold it in check." Never was this truer than in those febrile summer weeks of 1792. The range of the politically thinkable seemed to be expanding day by day, and the Assembly found itself rapidly outpaced by events. In the last week of July, the Austrian army crossed the northeast frontier. At the same time, the Duke of Brunswick, commander-in-chief of the Allied forces, declared their aim as the restoration of royal authority in France, threatening terrible vengeance against anyone who resisted. It was the final provocation. By the beginning of August, the sections were calling with almost one voice for the dethronement of the king. The Legislative Assembly, still trying to secure a compromise, found itself stranded dangerously far to the right of Parisian radical opinion. By the 9th of August, the section leaders had given up on it altogether. Matters came to a head on the 10th. In the early hours of the morning, the radical leaders seized power at the Hôtel de Ville, forming an insurrectionary commune to take over the government of the city. In the morning, a force of some 20,000 armed citizens, accompanied by detachments of provincial fédérés, marched on the Tuileries.